Thank you very much. First of all, thanks to Jason for inviting me. It's a great honor and privilege to be here and to give this talk. I should preface this with two comments. One is, it's a great pleasure to be in Prague. I have strong family connections with the city. I'm staying with my in-laws who live here. The last time I was in Prague was in 1988, coming up from a culling conference under the old regime, and the city's changed quite a bit, and I can say for the better. The second point is that it's a great honor and privilege to participate in a workshop dedicated to the memory of Fred Jelinek, or Jelinek. I had the distinct pleasure of coinciding with Fred at IBM in research in the early years of the 90s. He was in the speech group. I was in the natural language processing group in the computer science department. Fred was a colorful and much appreciated figure. At the time, I was not sympathetic to probabilistic modeling and linguistics. I would like to think he'd be proud of the direction in which my work has gone. At least he would say, I told you so. Fred was famous for his maxim, every time I fire a linguist, my system improves tenfold. The interesting thing is, it was a very revealing statement. It suggests a tough character who brooked no nonsense. Actually, Fred never fired anyone. He was an extremely supportive person who appreciated all kinds of research. And one thing he did was bring over Czech linguists, first generation of Czech linguists in the early 90s, who were recovering from a period of extended isolation and made a huge contribution to computational linguistics in this country, and I think in the world in general. So again, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak at a conference dedicated to his memory, which is something I cherish. Okay, I'm gonna talk a bit about probabilistic semantics, what kinds of approaches one could take, what the motivations are for doing it. I'm gonna indicate a rich type theory for probabilistic types, which is, this is all work that's in common with and joint with Robin Cooper, Simon Dobnik, and Stefan Larsson from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. This is work we've been doing over the last 2-3 years. It's still very much work in progress. I doubt if anything that I present today will last much longer than a few months because we're constantly revising, but let me share our thoughts with you now. Stefan will join us tomorrow and you'll have a chance to hear his application of this approach to dialogue. I'll talk about compositional semantics, which is what the rich type theory is intended to support, and also give you a very brief sketch of semantic learning. I might have to go kind of fast through some of the technical parts just to meet deadlines in time. I'll sort of focus more on the intuitive ideas behind the formulas, but I don't think anything terribly unfamiliar will be there, will be encoded there, and then talk about conclusions and future work. And then I hope I'll get a lot of interesting feedback and discussions from you. Okay, so classical semantic theories. I'm in the interesting situation of when I talk to linguists, who are, I suppose, I mean, if I'm anything, I'm a linguist, they will say, why are you doing this? This is insane. We never want to hear this again. And if I talk to computer scientists and cognitive scientists saying, why are you doing this? We could have told you this a long time ago. Go away. We've been doing it for years. So let me kind of give you an indication of why it is that we're doing what we're doing. So all of us in this group are coming out of a classical formal semantics background, most notably Robin Cooper, who's one of the truly distinguished figure. And I no need to indicate his work. But if you think about a classical semantic theory of the kind that Montague presents in the collected papers in 74, as well as revisions of that, approach in dynamic semantics, Camp and Ryle amongst others, and the Amsterdam group, Grunendijk and Stockhoff, dynamic logic, adapted from the dynamic logic of David Harel. And then under specified semantics, in a paper Chris Fox and I in 2010, discuss a whole variety of approaches to that. All of these could be called classical semantics and its children. Classical model theoretic semantics and its children use categorical type systems. By that, I don't mean categorical logic, but categorical type system means basically there's no probabilistic or fuzzy elements in them. They're built on top of set theories or alternatives to classical set theory. And a type is going to be identified as a possible denotation for an expression T. The theory is going to specify combinatorial procedures for combining denotations of expressions to get values of larger expressions. And one of the obvious problems that has always been swept under the rug as a sort of minor issue of detail is that the theories can't represent gradients of semantic properties like judgments concerning truth and predication, meaning relations, vagueness issues. These are the kinds of questions we were just talking about this morning. And they're, of course, entirely pervasive in semantics as they are in other areas of linguistic knowledge. Okay. The general approach is to say that these are matters of performance or processing or something of that sort. There's a fair amount of evidence that language acquisition in general crucially relies on probabilistic learning. So Alex Clark and I, in a book that came out in 2011 called Linguistic Nativism and the Poverty of Stimulus, discuss various kinds of probabilistic learning. It's just not clear how a reasonable account of semantic learning could be built on top of the categorical systems that either the classical or derived dynamic and underspecified theories assume. The reason is that these kinds of theories posit type systems just which don't look to be efficiently learnable from the primary linguistic data with weak learning biases using any of the kinds of learning algorithms that have been shown to be sound and adequate. There's also no psychological evidence to suggest that these kinds of classical categorical type systems provide biologically determined constraints on semantic learning. That is, that they're in some sense innate or they're learning biases that you posit as part of the system. In fact, a lot of the work on cognitive science in terms of categories suggests that plausible semantic categories in learning bear no resemblance to the type systems that we get either from Montague or from the revisionists. So our idea is to use probability to model gradients in learning. It's not our idea alone. I'm delighted to see lots of other people, most of them coming from computer science and cognitive science, where type theory is in computer science, part of the semantics of programming language, are coming to similar kinds of tentative working hypotheses. So if a semantic theory is going to assign probability rather than a truth condition to sentence, it's going to be in a better position to learn to do semantic learning, to accommodate those phenomena, and also to handle semantic gradients. Gradients is going to be intrinsic to the theory by virtue of the fact that values are going to be assigned along a continuum of real numbers rather than Boolean values. So, where gradients goes, vagueness follows. So if we can handle gradients, we can handle a whole variety of vagueness phenomena as well as underspecification. And a probabilistic count of semantic learning, now, semantic learning can be probabilistic, or any kind of learning can be probabilistic, but the object of learning doesn't have to be. So you can use, say, what's called PAC learning, probably approximately correct learning, developed initially by Les Valiant, and you can use it to learn non-probabilistic theories. But in fact, in work that Alex Clark, my co-author and colleague, has done, if you assume that the object of learning in the case of, say, a grammar is a probabilistic object that generates a distribution and you restrict the set of distributions to a certain limited class or subclass of possible distributions, then you facilitate learning. So that, in fact, if the object of learning is also probabilistic, you open up new possibilities of probabilistic learning, particularly in a PAC framework, but also in others. So the idea we have, and it seems we share it with people here, particularly with Jason and others, is that semantic interpretation, Dan Lasseter and various other people working along similar lines, although often coming to somewhat different conclusions or variant conclusions, is that semantic interpretation, semantic learning are best characterized as reasoning under uncertainty, and that a Bayesian approach, a broadly Bayesian approach, is the right initial strategy. But even once you've made that move, there are at least two possible strategies that you can identify for doing or constructing a probabilistic semantic. So one is a top-down approach, and that's going to sustain classical categorical type and model theory, and it's going to specify a function that assigns probability values to possible worlds that the model provides, where in this case, I'm understanding possible worlds in a kind of maximalist sense as an ultra filter in a lattice of propositions or a maximally consistent set, which is different than the notion of possible world that you get in AI approaches to probability theory, and that most of you perhaps have been using, the kind of notion of world that you get, say, in Halpern. I'm thinking that in this approach, I'm contrasting that, which is congenial, and which we reinterpret in terms of situation theory, with the notion of possible world that you get in the probability theory, say, of Carnap, or Jeff Paris, with kind of mathematicians' possible worlds, or the sense of possible worlds you get in Kripke frame semantics, where they're real worlds, they're full and maximal. So the probability value of a sentence relative to a model M on this approach is the sum of the probabilities of the worlds in which it's true. And on a bottom-up approach, which is the other approach I want to consider and which an adopt, is going to define a probabilistic type theory. Okay, so it's no longer a classical type theory as it is here. The probability value of a sentence is going to be the output of a function that encodes probabilistic semantic type judgments associated with its predicative syntactic constituents. Let's look for a moment at the top-down theory. This is something that a route that Jan van Eyck and I took in earlier work when I was visiting the CWI. There's now a published paper in a ILLC publication called Lyra. It's on my website if you want to get it. It's a 2012 paper. On the top-down theory that we built there, you retain classical type theory and you specify intentions for each type as functions from worlds to extensions as you do in Montague semantics. And then you just build a probabilistic model, which is going to be a tuple, in fact a triple, with a domain, a set of worlds, and a probability function. Probability values are assigned to worlds and they've got a sum to one. So that's pretty classical. And probability theory is classical, Komagora probability theory. And the interpretation of a language then is just going to be given in terms of the notion of a phi holding a world, and then you're going to give it a probability value by summing over the worlds in which it's true. The probability calculus of Kolmogorov is going to hold here. So, for example, not phi, its value is going to be 1 minus the value of phi. And if phi and psi are incompatible, then you're just going to get the value of their disjunction as the intersection of their worlds, which gives you summing of the values. Okay, sorry, if the intersection is null, you're going to get their probability value of a disjunction being the summing of their values. So everything is as it should be. The world is well behaved. We get to keep everything, both from Montague and Kolmogorov, intact. What the advantages then are precisely that. We get classical type and model theory, which we all grew up with, at least some of us did. And we get to use really well understood formal systems to encode representations, and we get to keep the standard probability calculus for computing the values of sentences in a way that seems pretty unproblematic, because we don't have to really worry about compositionality. That's handled in the classical type theory. Okay, what are the disadvantages? The disadvantages here is that it requires probability to be assigned to entire worlds. That is, there's no, in the way we built it, in this 2012 system, there's no marginalization. The worlds are real worlds, full maximal ultra filters and a lattice of proof theoretic lattice of propositions. And representing worlds in this way poses serious problems of tractability. And I've discussed this in other publications, as have my colleagues. We've given very detailed arguments as to why you have problems of completeness, of decidability, and even if those are taken out of the picture and you simplify down to finite kernel sentences in conjunctive normal form and add to them incrementally, you still end up with insuperable complexity problems and the KSAT type problem for satisfiability for worlds. So then you get as a result, because of this, you get a serious problem of how to compute probabilities of sentences for worlds or sets of possible situations. You get a kind of holism, and that seems to interfere with a reasonable theory of learning. And the theory of learning we do build up ends up being kind of definitional. Yeah.
Is this a good time for a question?
I think it's probably better if I run through it, and unless it's a clarificatory question. I mean, but if it's urgent.
Well, it's about this part about the top-down approach.
Okay.
So you're suggesting that restricting to finite worlds still leaves things being intractable, which is true.
Yeah.
And yet there's Markov logic, for example, as an approach that tries to do exactly that.
Yeah, you can do it. Sure.
Learning
sure. No, we're not saying it's impossible. We're not saying it's impossible. We're saying it's difficult. And if there's a better approach, then we should go for the better approach. Now, we think it's worth at least trying the second strategy. We think, in fact, the second strategy leads more naturally into a theory of learning and into vagueness, which just offers a richer framework that satisfies the tractability requirement in a more natural way. We didn't say the first approach won't work. So by all means, you know, you want to make the first approach work by limiting the set of worlds to tractably representable situations. We might end up meeting in the middle. We might end up being not that far apart. But at this point, we said, I mean, we tried it in the classical form. It's not going to work. A revised form, yeah, you're absolutely right. You could probably get tractable representations by cutting down the worlds in a reasonable way. We're just saying, in general case, it won't. Most people haven't worried about that. To the extent that you're worried about it and put it in the semantics, you might get the system off the ground. Then we can compare. Right. So this is not a dogmatic. You were saying, well, let's go with a second, see where we go, because it happens to fit into a nice theory of types. What we're doing is taking an independently developed type system called type theory with records, which is a rich constructive type system developed for other reasons that gets you all sorts of nice features of entailment and fine-grained semantic representation, which you don't get in the classical type theory. We're rendering it probabilistic, which we think we can do fairly naturally, and we seem to then reap the benefits of both the type system itself and the probabilistic representations. But that's not to rule out the possibility of other approaches, of course. Okay. So, let's go to the bottom-up approach. Bottom-up approach avoids representability problems because we're assigning probabilities to type judgments, where the types are basically classifiers for situation types. And the probability of a sentence is going to be determined relative to a bounded set of situation types, where we learn these as classifiers. We don't even have possible types. We just have only sort of situations. We have actual situations. If you, by the way, posit the set of some formal semanticists, myself included, a few years ago, worked with sets of possible situations and thought that would solve the problem because situations are partial worlds. It turns out the cardinality of the set of possible situations is an order higher than that of the set of, for any given world, the set of propositions, the maximal set of propositions. It's obvious why, because for any given world, you assume an infinite, even if countable, set of propositions. Maximally consistent, what's the set of possible situations for that world? It's a power set minus the null set. Cantor's theorem, you get a higher level. So it actually renders the problem of representability insuperable. So we don't have possible situations. We don't have actual situations. All the intentionality is going to be in the types, where the types are classifiers. Intentionality is understood differently. It's understood in terms of the distinction between operational and denotational content, which we borrow from the semantics of programming languages. This has all been discussed in other papers and publications, but by all means ask me about it if you want details and more information on that. So the bottom-up probabilistic semantics needs a probabilistic type theory because that's where all the action is, plus the problem then becomes how we handle compositionality. We no longer have a classical system. How do you combine probabilistic and non-probabilistic components of a semantic theory with a rich type theory to come up with something that's coherent and gets us the right probability conditions for sentences? That's really what we're doing. Our basic idea is that the theory is going to give us an account of semantic learning in which situation type classifiers are acquired through sampling and observation-driven Bayesian inference. So we kind of are reintegrating semantics into the general mainstream of cognitive science using these kinds of methods. We start with the notion of an Austinian proposition. So whenever the philosophers complain, I say, look, I'm a philosopher, I'm doing Austinian propositions. We take probability as distributed over situation types, where this notion has its basis in Barways and Perry. And an Austinian proposition is just going to be a judgment that a situation is of a particular type. But it's going to be probabilistic in this system. It's going to express a subjective probability relativized to an agent and a set of evidence statements that encodes the belief that the agent has that a certain situation is likely to probability value n, that the situation is of that type. So the core then of the Austinian proposition is just a type judgment, S is of type T, with the probability value being as we will indicate. So what I got to tell you about then is what our probabilistic type theory looks like. And here I'm going to go a bit fast, because what we're doing is we're taking Robin Cooper's type theory with records, which he developed in many places, but most recently in a publication in 2012. That's a volume that edited by Ruth Kemps and Tim Fernando and someone else. Oh, Nicholas Asher. And it includes the following types. So we're going to take these types, except they're probabilistic types as classifiers for us. So we have basic types, and they're not constructed out of other objects. We're going to have P types for predicate types, and they're constructed from a predicate and an appropriate sequence of arguments, such as man, John, 8, 10, 18, 10, 6, 10. That's the type of situation where John is a man at the type of 6, 10, at the time at 6, 10. We need a probability model that's going to give probability values for P types. And we take common nouns and verbs to provide components which are P types. This, of course, is just classical. Then we have meet and join types, and we're departing from more traditional kinds of constructive type theory here, which don't have those. We have them. So we have a join and a meet type. And we have type judgments that a situation is of a join or meet type. And the probability value, the equation which we use to compute that probability of a meet or join type, judgment is simply a variant of the classical Kolmogorov equation. It's just the product of A being of type T1, the probability of A being of type 1, and the conditional probability of A being of type 2 given that it's of type 1, right? And equivalently, that it's of both types, and similarly for disjunction, the sum minus this product. These are just classes. So we're just basically translating these classical equations into probabilistic type theory judgments. We have subtypes, and that's generally what's going to happen. So I'll skip over some of the equations just indicating what they mean. So we have subtypes, and that just, the subtype relation holds when A is a type T1 implies that A is a type T2. And they have this consequence that if T1 is of subtype T2, then it's going to be of subtype the meet of T1 and T2. And if it's of T1, and that's going to, right, that's going to hold if and only if this holds, A is of type T1, and A is of type T1 or T2, and that's going to hold if that holds. And these are just consequences. And similarly, these are various kinds of results which we can gain. What's the point of all of this subtyping? It gives us a way of encoding fine-grained classifier relations which otherwise would be handled by meaning postulates in a more classical system. So we can get semantic entailment without meaning postulates by using subtyping. That doesn't mean we can do all of those entailment relations, but we can get a lot of them. So that's why it's a richer system. I will pass over some of this. Because it would involve hardwiring lots of stuff that you want. It involved hardwiring into your semantics lots of stuff that you would want to be more flexible, right?
Things like relations among the basic
types. Yeah. Okay, so and there are various kinds of effects on probability that we get here. So for example, if T1 is a subtype of T2, then the probability that A is of type T1 is going to be less than or equal to probability. So here we have a quantitative relation replacing the entailment relation, both through the partial order. This entailment's also going to hold for the meet type. Okay. Now, we also can generalize meet to get a generalized probability just by generalizing over the product. This is, again, taking a classical characterization or equation for a conjunction and applying it to a type judgment. Now, this is the way we are following Jeff Paris here in treating generalized quantification as universal quantification as a generalized probabilistic meet, so that if, for example, n is going to be 0, then that is, there's nothing with a probability greater than 0 in this conjunction, then the whole thing's going to be 1. It's like essentially having a universal quantification. It's vacuous. And then we can do universal quantification in that way. And conditional conjunctive probabilities, right, are just characterized by the usual equations applied to type judgments. We also have generalized join, which then becomes a way we can define existential quantification. And again, this is the classical equation for join, for the probability of a join or a disjunction encoded for a type judgment. And if it's zero, that is, we have no element of the disjunct with a probability greater than zero, the whole thing's false. So we'll use this in our compositional semantics. We have functional types, and these are simply types that are functions from T1 to T2. And that's the type of total function with domain being the set of objects of type T1 and range including the objects of type T2. And the probability that a function f is of that type is the probability that everything in its domain is of type 1, which is of type 1, is also going to be in its range of type T2. And everything not in its domain, which has some probability of being of type T1, is not, in fact, of type T1. That's the way we characterize that. It's slightly problematic. The equation for it is simply a formalization of that idea. Right, we get the functional relation being a meet, probabilistic meet or conjunction with, take note of that for a moment. Let me flesh that out with some examples. Suppose that we have a T1 event, which is a flash of lightning, and a type T2, which is a clap of thunder. And F is going to map lightning events to thunder events. And so F is going to have its domain all events which have been judged to have probability greater than zero of being lightning events. And assume that all the lightning events are going to be, in fact, clear examples of lightning and are associated by F with clear events of thunder. Well, then they're going to have four pairs, right? And that's going to give us probability of one. That's the trivial case. Here's a more interesting case. Suppose that for one of the events, F is going to associate lightning with a silent event. So we've got one counterexample. What happens here is the formula then gives us the conclusion the whole functional type judgment's wrong. Because we have one counterexample, that's enough to throw out the whole system. Yeah?
So on the slide, why do you care about things which are not in the domain of?
Okay. Let me come to that. I'm going to come to that in a minute. I'm going to explain it. Yeah?
So just to make sure that I'm following all this stuff so far.
Yeah.
In general, the meaning of a linguistic expression is by the type.
Yes.
Which judges whether some entity or sentence or...
The type judgments are types of concerning situations.
What I should say is that the judgment whether an entity is an element of that type or ascribes to that type, is a question of whether that entity is likely to have the properties described by that linguistic expression. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've got a particular, that's defining a function which maps a lightning event to the thunder accompanying that lightning event.
Yeah.
And that's the meaning, this type is the meaning of the thunder event.
Yes, in that case, in this particular case. It's a situation, it essentially establishes a functional relation between situations of type T1 and situations of type T2 with a given degree of probability. Why do you care about things that are, in fact, those are things that are of type T1, but with below a threshold of probability. The question is what to do with those. Not that they aren't of type. They're in the domain, but their probability has been judged to be too low to be taken seriously. That's the question about those. This actually is something we've been arguing about in the group as to how to handle this. And at this time, this is the view that has prevailed. But before I get to that point, let me just mention one consequence of our treating functional types in terms of meets, unbounded in terms of our equation for the probability of computing meets or conjunctive types. So what you end up with then is the probability antecedent and consequent type judgments are both higher than zero. And the probability of the entire judgment is going to then decline, the whole functional type, in proportion to the size of the domain. It means more objects in the domain gives you lower probability. Why? Well, because it's a conjunctive type judgment. So it's just the product. So the more objects you have, the less likely it is that that functional type is hold. Now, of course, if they're all high enough, they'll give you the right probability. But it means that increasing the domain is going to decrease the probability of the functional type. And that might sound counterintuitive until you realize this is just a large conjunction. So that's OK. Now, the other question. Sorry? We're assuming that, naively assuming independence, yeah. Yeah, of course that changes once you change that assumption. Exactly right. Okay, so one other, okay. This I already said. I want to come to here's your question. This is the reply to your question. Functions which leave out some of the objects with lower likelihood of being type T1 should also have a probability of being of type T1 if in the functional type from T1 to T2, and that's why we put that in there, right? That's what this, yeah, this is intended to cover. Okay, that basically contributes through the product to influencing the probability of the whole type. So what you're doing is saying some objects are just, they're of type T1 and they're in domain, but their threshold is so low of being of that type, you want to allow them to influence the probability of the whole type judgment, but you want to control it. And that's the way we're doing it. Probably this is not the right way of doing it. We're going to have to refine it. But that was the motivation for it. OK, those are the examples. Let's get to the other kinds of types. OK, we also have negation. And here I'm only going to talk about judgment of a certain kind of negation. So we basically sustain Boolean negation here. Although it's a constructive type theory, we don't adopt the intuitionism of Martin Luf type theory. That's, of course, because we want classical probability theory, which is Boolean. So negation is just going to be the functional type from T to bottom, where bottom is the necessarily empty type, meaning the probability of it having any situations that satisfy is going to be zero. And we have a proof of a theorem and a lemma that essentially we get classical Boolean negation and disjunction out of that. And so we also get this. F is of type not T is going to be 1 if and only if its domain is empty. We also assign probabilities to judgment concerning non-emptiness of a type. So we actually have two kinds of type judgments. I'm not talking a lot about the second one. The first one is a situation of a certain type. What's the probability of that being the case? The other is a type inhabited or not, which is more like a kind of existential assertion. There is or is not instances. There are or there are not instances of that type, and we have rules for that. But I'm not going to talk about those at this point for reasons of lack of time. As I said, we have we prove a theorem and a lemma, or a lemma and a theorem, that gets us classical Boolean negation and disjunction, given our equations for the negative type, and that's because it's a functional type to bottom, and therefore we depart from Martin Luf. We have dependent types, which is how we handle anaphora following Arne Ranta. Those who are not familiar with it, ask me about it, but it's a very particularly elegant way of handling certain kinds of anaphora and coreference patterns. And these are functions from objects to types. So given appropriate arguments, as functions are going to give us back a type as a value. And the account of probabilities associated with functions also is going to apply to dependent types. We have record types. Now, record types are sets of ordered pairs or fields. First member is a label. The second member is an object of some type, possibly itself a record, so we have a reentrant structure. And the records are functions on labels. So each label in a record can only occur once in a left projection in a pair. OK, and then we have rules for defining these records. I'm not going to give you the rules because I'm running kind of short on time. What I will do is simply ask you to think in terms of attribute value structures in a type feature structure like HPSG. So basically, the record types allow us to incorporate that kind of rich reentrant feature structure But instead of using unification, we have full functionality or function application because we are in a type system rather than in a feature logic. And the record types are the kind of reentrant embedded recursive feature structure patterns that you get in those systems, except they're functional. And this is how we define them. I'll pass over these recursive definitions. The probability that an R is of a record type is going to be 1 if it's a record and 0 otherwise. So we get binary. And then we have a characterization of how to extend it. Again, I'm going to skip this for reasons of time. The real question that is at the center of all of this, because it's a bottom-up strategy, and the one that you should be asking yourself about is, how do we deal with composition? How do we deal with compositionality in the system? And this is actually a problem for many non-standard semantic theories, not only probabilistic semantics when you're going bottom-up. Top-down, you don't have the problem keeping classical type theory. Bottom-up, you do. So those of you who are familiar with vector space semantic models and latent semantic analysis, this is a big problem. If you want to go beyond word and fixed phrase identification to get vector space values that'll give you a way of applying metrics like cosine, you have to have some way of combining vector space values that's non-arbitrary and that follows the syntax. A lot of work being done on that area. People like Greffenstadt and Steve Clark have produced a lot of nice work using category theory on how to do it, but it remains a serious issue. And we're confronted with a kind of analogous problem. Given that we've already characterized our type theory, I think our problems are less severe because we don't deal with vectors, which represent, in effect, in the vector spaces, distributional patterns of words over dimensions in texts. But we are dealing with probability values of classifiers with respect to situations. So we got at least something connecting us to the world, and we've opened up truth values into the probability values. We still have the problem how to make sense, how to take probabilistic functions and apply them to types which are expressions which may have non-probabilistic interpretation. So the general approach we've taken now is to say, okay, what we do is, look, what Montague did, remember, is he took functions and applied them to intentions of expressions. So in this kind of value of an NP applying to the intention of the value of a VP, right? And that was a way of handling, it was a generalized principle. It was dictated actually by the homomorphism condition on the mapping of categories to types that allowed him to handle, to give unified interpretations of the whole class of noun phrases as generalized quantifiers and more significantly of modifiers, both intersective and non. We're taking in a variant of this strategy. What we're saying is that the compositional semantics is going to take a probabilistic function associated with a certain kind of type and apply to a non-probabilistic or categorical semantic value to give us probabilistic values. Okay, and we'll see how that works in a minute. So for sentences, it's going to return a probability value for the sentence. And we can give a Montague-style characterization of a compositional semantic. So for a conjunction, we're going to end up with a probability. This is just the beginning, the top part, the vanilla part. We'll get into the details in a minute. Disjunction is going to give us probability of a meet type, values of a meet type for a situation, negation, etc. Everything will work according to that pattern. Of course, this is only interesting if we can say something about the particular inhabitants of these types. So negation is going to give us essentially a function on record types of a certain kind to give us a probability that a situation is of a negative type. The quantifiers will look like generalized quantifiers, you know, curried functions on property types, but in the core for computing the value of the sentence, which whose frame they define or kernel they define, we'll get a typed value, a probabilistic value that a situation is of that type, and similarly for the others. Okay, similarly for the adjectives, and if you want, adverbs will work this way. We'll again be functions on record types where the record types take us from individuals into the probability that a certain situation holds, the green type situation of the record associated with the individual and the property, similarly for imaginary, okay, and on. Okay, now what we need is a probability distribution for a fragment to give us a model. So a probability distribution is just based on a set of situations. And here's an example case. So the probability that A is an individual is 1 if A is Kim or Sandy. These are probabilities that a situation is of a certain type. It's going to be 0, 1 if S of S and T of P type, etc. This means A is of type, A is of an instantiated type P for the set of things that are P. This is going to be the P type for sum, just a conjunctive type judgment. This is for that distribution. This is for every universal quantification can be defined in terms of a functional type, and the reason we can do that is we've already defined functions as a conjunction, a probability of a conjunctive judgment. Most is going to be the minimum of one or the probability relative to the distribution that a conjunctive type holds or that a coefficient, which is a context-dependent judgment for what it most holds, is going to be normalized, or it's going to normalize this conjunctive type, okay? And probabilistic generalized quantifiers then are just going to give us probabilistic judgments that these kinds of conjunctive or disjunctive or functional types hold. So for the most case in words, what we get is the likelihood that E is of the type most for P and Q is the likelihood that E is of the type P, the join P and Q, meet P and Q, factored by the product of a contextually determined parameter theta most. That is, does it have to be 70%? Does it have to be 80%? And the likelihood that E is of the type P, where this fraction is less than 1 and 1 otherwise. Notice that for both universal and most, we're using conjunctive through functions. So here's an example. So we want the probability that Kim smiles. So here we get a Montague-style derivation using lambda terms, which in this case are functions on record types for properties for Kim and for smile. We apply it, we do lambda reduction, we get the probabilistic judgment that a situation E is of the type that Kim smiles in E. Suppose that we have three situations, S1, S2, S3, with these probabilities for Kim smiling at 0.7, 0.3, 0.4, and there are no other situations which are relevant. Then the probability distribution is going to give us, and we're assuming independence naively, as was pointed out. So we just basically then say the probability Kim smiled is just the join for these three, and that's going to come down to 0.874. Okay. Now, here's another example. No, this is just a continuation of that example, sorry. So basically then for any given expression, its value for a probability distribution is just going to be the result of computing according to the compositional rules for getting its interpretation with respect to the probability distribution D, and that's why we got that. So the whole sentence is just going to have a probability value given the agent's understanding of the likelihood of the three relevant independent situations of 0.874 that Kim actually smiled. Okay, so then Austinian propositions are just going to, instead of being either true or false, are going to have these probability values. They're just basically judgments that a given situation is of a certain, is a situation of a certain type with that given probability. That's what the whole sort of focus of the semantics is about. The definition is going to specify a compositional procedure for generating Austinian propositions of that type from the meanings of the syntactic constituents. Now, what I have here is a brief introduction to our learning account, but it seems to me that I'm out of time. So I will probably have to skip that, otherwise you won't have a chance to ask questions. Let me then summarize it, because we have a procedure for generating Bayesian probabilistic judgments on. So this, the whole point of the learning theory is how to get these basic and p-types out of learning as classifiers, because what we're doing then is feeding our compositional type system from actual observations of judgment of situations in the world, and you learn. So we want basically the basis of our semantics not to be an abstract model theory, but to be a theory of learning how to classify situations with mentor-driven learning in the sort of unrealistic, idealized cases. I'll pass over the technical detail. which tells us how to get Bayes classifiers, which are really compressed Bayes networks. And I'm not going to tell you about that right now. You can see we've done some of the work on this. Okay, let me tell you how this is going to work. So what we've done is we've built a probabilistic rich type theory with records as a basis of a compositional semantics, and I very quickly showed you how the semantics will work to allow you to compute probabilistic Austinian propositions as the interpretations of sentences. Now, in this, the framework differs from a model theoretic semantics of a classical variety in, amongst other things, the way in which basic types and type judgments, which are the foundations of the whole type system, because the rest is built up compositionally in the type system too, meets, joins, functions, and subtypes, and record types. These are going to correspond to perceptual judgments concerning objects and events in the world. So there's a strong learning theoretic basis for the whole semantics. So, and rather than positing entities in an abstract model theory and a Kripke frame semantics and set theoretic constructions defined in terms of them, we're basically saying you're learning classifiers through sampling Bayesian inference, and that's where you're going to get the types. These are the categories. And out of that, you're going to build your type system, and then you have the compositional procedures for combining expressions of different types to get Austinian judgments on the sentences. So this is the kind of general architecture we have in mind. We've given a schematic view of learning, which I haven't given you, unfortunately, because I'm out of time, but I'll post the slides. And actually, a variant of this talk is already posted on my website. If you look on the NASLE, there's a set of NASLE slides. So if you go to my website, my personal website, you'll see one of the items that comes up is NASLE 2014. So the fifth and final class contains much of this material, including the learning site, so you can have it, but I will post this also. So the basic probabilistic types of the semantics are taken from these classifiers, which are learned in the way I've indicated, and which is a fairly standard approach to Bayesian learning and in hierarchical Bayesian learning, which has become dominant in certain parts of cognitive science, certainly out of what I call the good part of MIT, the Jeff Tenenbaum part, Josh Tenenbaum part. And the proposed type theory is going to be now the interface. So this is now the interface between learning, observation-based learning of classifiers for objects and situations, and the compositional semantics that gives us interpretations of complex expressions. And so this is where the whole approach differs radically from classical model theoretic semantics. The representations are, in this sense, connected directly with cognitive learning, with perceptual learning. And that's why we wanted to go for a bottom-up and rather than a top-down approach. This is, we think, very much the payoff in this sort of strategy. And what we then get is a situation of meaning in the rest of cognition. In other words, semantics is returned to the general repertoire of cognitive activities, where you're constantly making judgments about what kinds of situations obtain or don't obtain in the world, using probability theory as a basis for making those judgments and inferencing about them. In future work, we're going to develop our Bayesian reasoning concerning observations to get a much more refined account of how we get predicative types. We'll basically work this into a theory of Bayesian networks. We're also going to look at implementations of this, which will start with modeling certain kinds of robotic language learning and dialogue modeling to see how artificial agents might conceivably, through Bayesian learning of classifiers, actually acquire type systems that would allow them to then converse about things like spatial location. So, let me stop there and leave room for discussion and questions. Yeah.
That the top-down model view is kind of runs into computational problems because you have to consider the entire world and it could be very complex. And that's true if you're modeling all the dependencies in the world. So I guess it wasn't quite clear to me if you're doing this bottom-up approach where you have these type judgments, there's still independence assumptions that you're kind of making.
Yes.
And are you making, let's say, less of them in some, are you making them kind of judiciously, or if you were to make the same assumptions, independence assumptions in the world, then maybe you could
A very apt and appropriate question. Where do you make independence assumptions? How justified are they? It's a general problem in doing probabilistic modeling and reasoning, looking for dependencies amongst variables. And it's certainly going to be a very severe problem for us. We hope we can deal with it by simply focusing on limited tasks. But for a realistic model of language acquisition that handles concept learning in connection with the sorts of types we need to drive our semantics, it's a big issue. Yes, you're right, we could well run into tractability problems very quickly, as well as a host of other issues. So what I've given you is a program rather than a theory, and the program will, of course, have to deal with those issues. I am entirely sympathetic to the point you're raising. I do think, however, that we stand at least a better chance than a top-down approach in coping with the question of how learning individual classifiers is possible, and then connecting it with a compositional semantics. When we tried to do this together, Jan and I, what we found is we were just basically giving definitional accounts of learning. That is, you could only learn all of the predicates at once. You couldn't learn individual predicates in the sort of system we had. Now, that could be because we were just characterizing worlds the wrong way, and if we took a more reasonable approach to worlds by marginalizing, we wouldn't have that problem. In which case, I think we get closer to the approach that ends up being being bottom-up. But yeah, independence assumptions are the bane of much work in probabilistic reasoning, of course.
If no one else is asking, can you say a bit more, when you're doing learning, what is the data that you're learning from?
Like, what's the data? We don't yet have data.
Not real data, but like, what is the form of data? Is it examples of sentences or words paired with?
Well, we'd start with words, I think. We'd start with words and, you know, predicates. Very much the way that, say, Noah Goodman and Dan Lasseter are looking at, they're doing through simulation and some real data, how you would acquire predicates. We'd start with those, and then we'd look at how you would build up phrases. So that would be the data. We'd look at real learning. We look at simulated learning. We haven't done any of that because we're still working out the formal framework.
So you only have classifiers at the lexical level, or you have classifiers?
Well, not necessarily. You could, of course, have complex classifiers, of course. But you would start, I think, with, if you wanted to follow something like a realistic acquisition schedule, we would start with basic lexical items, yeah. And then learn how to build more complex classifiers. Don't have to, but I would have thought that would be more natural, given that children tend to learn lexical items as individual items initially before combining them.
Oh, over.
Yeah.
Hi. Very thought-provoking talk.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing.
Very thought-provoking talk.
Thank you.
So I like examples, so I kind of glommed onto your Kim Smiles example, and I think I must have misunderstood it. So you had three previous instances of Kim smiling?
Yes.
And probability 0.7, 0.3, and 0.4?
Yeah.
And then now this is a new instance of Kim possibly smiling?
Yeah. You want to assign a general probability to the type, to the Austinian proposition Kim smiles, and you have this kind of data. That's your data and your probability distribution. So you want to know what are the probability conditions for Kim smiles?
Right. Well, you ended up with a probability of 0.874.
Yes.
And I guess I don't understand how. So are you including the fourth instance?
No, there is no fourth instance.
So that's just based on the original three instances.
Yeah, your model is that distribution of three. It's not intended to be realistic.
Is that really what you want? I mean, if your highest probability of Kim smiling in the previous three instances is 0.7, do you really want to end up with a probability of 0.874?
Because you'd say, there are these three distinct situations, and you've got this, well, now, you know, in in general, what's the likelihood of her smiling, given that these are what you've observed? You would end up with that.
But don't you need to know other stuff, like of all the times Kim has been in the room or Kim has been with these particular people or something, how many of those times?
Yeah, sure. Those would be conditional probabilities that you would want to put into a real model, yes.
Because without any of that context, it still seems odd that you'd want to go from probabilities that are all lower than 0.7 or lower to something that's 0.8.
Yeah. No, why should, in other words, you're saying...
Is that really what you want?
So far, yes, but I'm feeling the force of your comment.
Okay.
Saying, given the model, I mean,
So I understand what's going on. This is a guess, but is it right that the three reports of Kim smiling are all about the same instance?
Yes.
It's three different observers of the same situation. One person assigns a 70% chance that she was smiling, somebody else assigns a 40% chance, and so forth.
They're one report. They're three people reporting on three different situations.
Oh, it is three different situations.
There are three different situations.
Okay. And so now the 0.874 is the probability that she has smiled at least once?
It's a probability of that of there being any situation in which she smiles, of that being instantiated, yeah.
Okay, and so there exists.
Yeah.
So there was some point in the compositional story where I got lost, because I thought the meaning of Kim smiles was going to be a type which was then going to be interpreted as a proposition. No, I'm sorry. Interpreted as a function that gives you the probability for any classifier that that classifier, in fact, tells you whether Kim smiles.
Okay, no. There are two. I conflated two things here. There are two kinds of judgments. One is that a given type is actually instantiated at all, and the other is that a given situation is of a certain type. Okay. So what I gave you here, this was my lack of clarity, is actually the judgment on that type of situation of Kim smiling actually holding at all, at any given case. The another case would be, here's a situation.
What is it to mean to hold it all? So in the first half of your talk, you had judgments of the form probability of A colon T.
Yes.
What is A?
A is a situation.
It's holding of a particular situation.
Yes,
so A is fixed throughout the situation.
Right, okay. So you're pressing correctly on an ambiguity of my presentation. The first one, I was talking to you in the compositional semantics and the type theory about judgments concerning individual situations being of a certain type. The other kind of judgment is that the type itself is just instantiated at all, that it's inhabited. Okay, the likelihood that anything, there will be a situation of a certain type. When we got the three situations giving us a 0.8, the question Martha is asking, that was the second kind of judgment, that what's the likelihood of it being inhabited at all?
Non-emptiness.
Right. Now, to get judgments regarding a given situation, that situation is, when you were asking, is there a fourth situation? No. But let's say there's a fourth situation, you want to know whether that situation holds for that situation, the judgment that situation is of a certain type holds, you would use different procedures. They'd be directly related, but that would be a judgment of a certain situation being of a certain type. There you would have priors, and there you would have, and you would compute the posterior, and there you would get, I think, an intuitively satisfying result. So you were correct to demand that be distinguished. I ran them together because there are, in fact, two components. The semantics. One is this generic judgment that a type is inhabited, and the other by a situation of any kind, and the other is that a given situation is of this type. You were thinking I was talking about the latter in that example. Foolishly, on my part, I didn't make it clear I was talking about the former. Okay? So thank you. Those are very useful and helpful. Next time I present it, I'll make that clear.
One other question. Can you... maybe go back to the slide where you showed the compositional interpretation. Probabilistic interpretation of NP being applied to non-probabilistic interpretation of BP.
This?
Yes. Next slide, maybe. So there's something here with an asymmetry between the probabilistic and non-probabilistic interpretations. And I was trying to understand what linguistic implication that might have.
So if you look here, I mean, every case where you have, for example, a noun, etc., these are all cases...
Here, this one here. Okay. So if you look at line 4.
Yeah.
So only one of those is probabilistic.
This one, yes.
Yeah. And is this like some topic? I'm trying to get my head around why only one of these is interpreted probabilistically, and what linguistic implication that may have.
So let's go to here, right? So these are the right? So what you're doing is you're saying these are the this is the probabilistic function for sum, right? It's going to give you this, which is a curried function on record types. But the core is a probabilistic type judgment, and that's going to apply to a non-probabilistic noun, right? Like boy, right? That's not going to be probabilistic. That'll tell you that you're looking at the likelihood that the sum relation holds between boy and something else. Okay, so the idea is that this is basically a way, you don't want probability to be compositional on probabilities, right? You don't want to, because you'll get nonsense out of that. You don't want to say every function is going to be a probabilistic function on a probabilistic value. This is a compositional semantics. We're basically doing, redoing Montague semantics in a probabilistic mode, right? So
what is E in that?
Sorry?
What is E?
What is?
E
is situation.
But is that a free variable? Is that fixed?
Yeah, it's a free variable. It's a parameter here.
But it doesn't appear on the left-hand side, so...
No. It's going to be bound independently. It's either,
So the probabilistic denotation of sum depends on some E?
Sorry?
I guess...
It'll depend on a given E. It'll either depend on a given E, or it'll be a generic judgment that a given type is instantiated.
Okay. So the left-hand side has implicit dependence on E as
yes,
well.
It has an implicit situation variable.
Okay.
Or parameter. That's correct.
Let's take